The last thing you want to do is be billing out for Spravato, having the cost of the drug potentially, and then not being able to get paid for a single dime of it until you get it corrected 6 months down the road. That's a huge costly mistake if you're going to try to continue treating your patients in the meantime.
Welcome to the Psychiatry Tomorrow podcast. I'm Dr. Carly McMillan, and in each episode, we interview thought leaders in the deep end of psychiatry's next frontier. Dive into the latest research, innovative treatments, technology, and policy developments shaping the future of psychiatry. Join us on this journey to discover what's next in mental health care so you can stay ahead of the curve. So today we're shining a spotlight on an exciting and promising treatment option for treatment-resistant depression and acute suicidality. That is intranasal esketamine, also known as Spravato, that's FDA approved and covered by most major insurance companies, which is just so huge for access for so many who are unable to afford or access IV ketamine or IM ketamine. If you're thinking of incorporating this revolutionary treatment into your private practice, hopefully this episode will serve as a guide to kickstart that process. So in this episode, we'll share key insights from what I actually learned from being one of the first, if not the first, practices in New York City to add Spravato when it was approved by the FDA in 2019. I'm joined by Brittany Wagner of Tidemark VA. Brittany's a revenue cycle management consultant who you'll see is just a true expert, just like a billing Jedi when it comes to insurance billing of Spravato. She certainly helped my practice out a lot over the years and helps out many other practices that we work with. We'll touch on the efficacy, safety, and side effects of Spravato, but mainly we'll be focusing on essential business considerations, logistics, incorporating measurement-based care, navigating the REMS program, all while utilizing technology like Osmind that makes the process just a lot more manageable. Starting a Spravato service can definitely be a bit intimidating at first, but by the end of this episode, I hope that you'll all have a deeper understanding of the benefits, practical aspects, and financial considerations of offering this innovative and what I've really seen in practice to be a life-saving treatment. I certainly wish that I had a guide like this when I was getting started, and rather than just sort of fumbling around in the dark submitting insurance claims. If you have any patients that you treat with treatment-resistant depression or acute suicidality, would definitely strongly consider adding Spravato to your toolkit, or at least finding colleagues in your area to refer to who are offering it. And with that, let's dive in.
My name is Sarah McGuire. I'm the marketing manager and community lead here at Osmind. Thank you for being with us here today to learn the basics of adding Spravato to your practice. We have a lot of content to cover, and we want to make sure we have a little bit of time to hold some space for some questions. And, you know, whether you're considering offering Spravato or just want to understand the business model from a competitor perspective, this webinar, you're in the right place. So thank you so much for being here. We are happy to host this webinar with an insurance and billing expert, Brittany Wagner, therapist and founder of Tidemark VA Services, and Dr. Carlene McMillan, a practicing psychiatrist and chief medical officer here at Osmind. Dr. Carlene's New York clinic was actually one of the first, if not the actual first, to offer Spravato in its practice when it came to market. And Tidemark has developed expertise over the years in learning and the intricacies of billing for it. Just a quick overview for those of you who may not know Osmind, the host for today's webinar. We are an EHR and premier technology platform for breakthrough mental health treatment and research. Our mission is to empower clinicians and researchers who bring innovative treatments to patients who need it most. If you're interested in learning more, please visit osmind.org. So we'll do a brief overview of Spravato for those who don't know too much about it. Some billing and insurance techniques and kind of general information, business considerations, setting and systems, and then how the Osmind EHR platform can actually support offering Spravato in your practice, and then carving out some time for some live Q&A from our panelists. You know, we'll try to save all the questions towards the end. So excellent. Without further ado, I'm actually going to pass this over to Carlene to do an overview of Spravato. Take it away.
All right. Thanks so much, Sarah. So as folks are probably aware, Spravato, otherwise known as esketamine, is a nasal spray that was developed by Janssen and approved by the FDA in 2019 alongside an oral antidepressant for adults with treatment-resistant depression. And then subsequently, about a year later, it got an FDA indication for individuals with acute suicidal ideation, which is actually pretty unique as far as medications go at the time. And it's part of this sort of larger class of what we consider to be rapid acting antidepressants. So S-ketamine is the S enantiomer of ketamine. I think folks maybe remember from organic chemistry that, you know, there's two sides of each molecule. This is the left-sided part of the molecule. And while ketamine itself was approved for anesthesia by the FDA in 1970 and was used sort of in military fields and such prior to that, Spravato, it was a huge, really big deal for our field because it was the first FDA approved indication of any sort of ketamine compound for psychiatric use. So, you know, all of the usage of IV and IM ketamine or oral ketamine, things like that, are all still to this day off label. So this, you know, the arrival of Spravato meant that suddenly insurance companies were a lot more interested in paying for an on-label treatment, and indeed more, essentially more mandated to. So as folks know, ketamine is an NMDA receptor antagonist that enhances glutamate release in the brain, excitatory neurotransmitter, we think leads to all sorts of sort of neuronal growth, exciting changes. And the reason that S enantiomer was chosen was because it has about a 4-time greater affinity for the NMDA receptor than just regular ketamine alone. So it was felt to be the likely winner. There are trials going on of the R enantiomer and things like that, but this felt like the safest bet. So how does Spravato dosing work? So it is self-administered by the patient. I think some folks don't realize that. It's something that it's an in-office only treatment. No home use is approved, but the patient will actually administer themselves. I liken it to like a little Afrin spray, and it does get delivered directly to your clinic. It's approved in two different strengths, 56 or 84 milligrams. And so each one is 28. So a full treatment would be like 3 sprays. And the typical regimen is that for the first month, for the first 4 weeks, it's twice a week. And then after that, we would typically go to weekly for at least another month. And then what happens kind of after that second month really depends on if the person is responding, if, you know, what their schedule is like, what their insurance coverage is like, a lot of logistical factors. But I think oftentimes we're seeing in the real world that people end up being on this for, you know, up to 6 months or so, maybe not every week, but every other week. I've seen monthly, sort of similar to ketamine in that once you get through that sort of induction starter phase, there's quite a bit of variability and no clear consensus on what should be done. Common side effects, there can be some dissociation, some dizziness and sedation, although not too bad. Slight transient increases in blood pressure. We do check it during the treatment, at least 40 minutes in and at the end. And usually between like by an hour and a half, most people's blood pressure has normalized. And the upper end, like 3 hours or so. And typically I've found that people whose blood pressure persists a little bit more and end up needing to stay in the office a little bit longer tend to be folks who are also on stimulants. Also can cause sort of mild nausea. So sometimes we might prescribe Zofran to take with it, although pretty rare. Slight euphoric mood, feeling a little bit, and slight vertigo. So, you know, always wanting to assist someone going to the bathroom, similar things that you would do when you have ketamine in your office. Although generally, even at the 84 milligram dose for most folks, it can be a little bit more mild. And so it is only allowed under a very restrictive program called a REMS. So risk evaluation mitigation strategy. This is something that the FDA does when they're particularly worried about a medication because of its side effect profile, or it's just so new, or there's just weirdness about it that makes them uneasy. Another example of a REMS program would be Accutane, which, you know, caused terrible pregnancy defects. So we'll talk a little bit more about the REMS later, but it does mean that you have to follow a strict protocol. Patients have to be in the office for at least 2 hours. You can't send them home early, even if they wish to. The REMS folks will give a call the next day and be displeased. So just quickly on the research, I realize people might want to get into the weeds here on this, so encourage folks to go to the actual studies. But Janssen did three studies, three randomized controlled studies to try to determine whether or not this could beat placebo. And of these three studies, they're called the Transform studies. Only the second one showed statistical significance on day 28. The third one was in patients that are 65 years or older, so kind of special population. And the first one did not separate from placebo. But one thing I would like to highlight here is that the placebo was actually an active arm. All of these patients were also started on an oral antidepressant, a new oral antidepressant, prior to starting Spravato. So that's kind of an unusual trial design, and I think was just done because they didn't want people to not be on anything. But by introducing a new antidepressant, you know, you're also, there's a chance that that could be working for folks. So people in the placebo group tended to do pretty well as well. And then in addition, there's just novelty to this. There's a lot of attention, a lot of visits. So there's pretty high placebo response. There was high rates of dissociation in the placebo group. So there are some complexities to this, just to think about those results maybe not being as blockbuster as we might hope in that controlled setting. They did do a longer term sustained trial, which did show statistically significant response. And then finally, they did two additional trials regarding suicidality. And these are called the Aspire trials. These did separate from placebo and are part of what led to the approval for suicidal ideation. And again, we're seeing rapid reduction in that suicidal thinking and dysphoria within 24 hours, which is really quite, really quite remarkable. So now I'll turn it over to Brittany to talk a little bit about billing and insurance.
Yeah. So, I mean, the first step to billing for Spravato specifically is you're going to have to decide whether you're going to want to be in network or out of network. You should probably realize that both of the, whether you're in network or out of network, it's pretty much always going to require an authorization from the payers. But again, this is going to vary by payer to payer, state to state. So you're going to have to definitely check with your insurance plans. And as you're thinking about billing out for Spravato or seeing if you want to plan it in your practice, you're really going to need to decide whether you want to use a person's pharmacy benefit plans or whether you're going to want to potentially do buy and bill. And what buy and bill means is essentially you're going to contact distributors that are in your area and you're going to purchase the medication and then receive it at your clinic for administration. And there's a couple of key factors that really go into deciding whether you want to do buy and bill or solely use a person's benefit pharmacy benefit plans. Number one is going to be the cost to the patient and exploring that with them and whether it's something that they can afford. You should be aware that there is a Janssen and Me savings plan that people could potentially qualify for. And over the course of their lifetime, it could cover up to $8,500 of that potential cost for that patient. So that is something that they could explore. And then you're going to want to be looking at the cost of what the drug is going to cost you if you are going to be doing buy and bill. And then you're going to need to compare that against your fee schedules for your buy and bill codes, which we'll get into here in just a second. And it may be that your profit margins aren't large enough for particular payers for you to even do buy and bill. The other thing that you're going to need to consider is if you are an out-of-network provider, it is very possible that you actually may not be able to secure a prior authorization. I want to be clear about that because they could say in a 30-mile radius that particularly they want to use an in-network provider and that there's plenty of that going on, or that you aren't specialized or niched enough, or that your clinical documentation isn't good enough. These are some of the common things that we go through, but they tend to deny prior authorizations more commonly for out-of-network providers than for in-network providers. And then the other thing that you're going to want to consider too, when deciding about buy and bill and whether to use the patient's pharmacy benefit plans, is just really ultimately, if you are out of network, you're not going to necessarily know what those rates of reimbursement are going to be until you actually try to secure that prior auth, because they may not even release those codes. And that is even true if you are in network, because sometimes with the specialty codes that I'll get into in just a second, they don't include those on the usual fee schedules, even if you are in network. So you won't see those rates until you request one prior auth. So what we typically tend to recommend for practice owners is test one out. It can even be yourself. It could be a colleague's insurance benefit plans. Go ahead and go through the hoops of, you know, securing a verification of benefits, seeing what kind of prior authorization requirements are needed, if there's a particular form that you have to fill out, and so on. And then you'll get a good indicator of what those rates of reimbursement are even before you open your clinic doors, if, you know, that's where you're at in your planning process. So in regards to prior authorizations, what type of services require these and which ones don't? Typically, the pharmacy is going to require a prior authorization for the medication. And that's pretty much going to be true across all pharmacy benefit plans. And it may be that you have to use a preferred pharmacy that is just contracted out with Janssen, who's gone through their own requirements and met that certification protocol. Is in regards to services, you're going to definitely see that for any buy and bill codes that you're going to need to request a prior authorization. And for Medicare, those codes look a little bit different. They're your G codes, which will be listed on a slide afterwards, just in case you guys want to write it down. And I believe the G codes for Medicare are pretty much going to require a prior authorization. And the S code, which is specifically your buy and bill for a lot of commercial plans. I do want to be clear in saying that historically, the G code was just separate for Medicare reimbursement entirely. That is not necessarily the case now. So when you're conducting your prior authorization requests and your verification of benefits, regardless of whether it's a commercial plan, Medicare plan, or Medicaid plan, you need to be asking for all of the codes that are going to be listed on this upcoming slide, just to cover all of your bases, because it may be that one of those codes is a higher rate of reimbursement than the other. Hardly ever your office visits would require a prior authorization. If they are going to require a prior authorization, and you would only be using these office visits if you were not conducting buy and bill. I want to be clear about that. And you might only see a prior authorization request if you're doing a prolonged session, for example, and you've done several in a row, like in a very short amount of time frame. They might request for a prior authorization after so many units were exhausted during a certain set duration. As far as prior authorizations go, what do you need to try to get your best rate of acceptance, like straight out the gate? The first thing I should say is the more often that you can do it in provider portals, the better. So the more electronic it is, the better it is. If you're having to fill out a PDF and fax it and or mail it in, because some plans still do require that, there's always a chance and a risk that that can get lost somewhere in somebody's desk, in somebody's trash can, whoever gets a hold of it. And so you will have to be more diligent about following up with those with particular plans. So what is it that really gets a prior authorization approved? It really boils down to your clinical documentation and how thorough you are with that. What they're typically looking for is they're wanting to see failed trials of antidepressants historically. They're wanting to see that they are currently attending therapy with a therapist and that at least the treatment plan is going well and it's staying on track as far as their treatment goals are measured. And if they aren't engaged with the therapist at the time of your consult, make sure you give them referrals to a therapist, because the sooner that they can see that, the better the likelihood for them to approve the treatment. And they're going to want to know all of the procedure codes that you're going to want to utilize, how often you're going to want to utilize it, and the total number of visits. They are also, they really like, tend to like PHQ-9s, Beck depression inventories, any sort of assessments that are objective and that are trackable. So if your patients can either potentially bring that in from another provider, like say their PCP that they were attending, or you're performing those at the time of your consult, more often than not, what we're seeing is patients aren't coming in with like their PCP paperwork already, like, and so typically most prior authorizations will go through just based upon that initial consult, as long as you're thorough with it. They're going to want to also know what dosage units you're planning on administering during that 8-week course of treatment. Is it going to be the 56 milligram or is it going to be the 84 milligram? And they're definitely going to want to know what their psychiatric background was when it comes to family history, own personal history, prior hospitalizations, especially. And they're going to want to know that you agree to treat them. And if they're pregnant, that you're going to inform them of the risks associated if they are pregnant, and just that you're going to do your due diligence in monitoring them and tracking them for any adverse effects.
Actually, before we go on to the actual codes too, I wanted to add something just from my kind of a perspective on these. So usually when we would try to get these, like the first step would be actually to call Janssen, and they do some kind of checking and will let you know kind of what tree you're barking up. And I think we mainly found, and this may have shifted and been very payer to payer, but like certain payers required pharmacy benefit usage or required buy and bill. Like I wasn't necessarily always given a choice. So more often than not, it was decided for me. And there are definitely advantages and disadvantages to both. And then the other real thing that would really get us with the prior auths was this concept of needing to be on another oral antidepressant during the treatment. This was how the trials were done with Janssen. And keep in mind that Janssen had people start a new antidepressant. So with some payers, they are satisfied just to see that the patient is on an antidepressant. They've been on Zoloft for years, not working, but they're on it. Great. Keep them on it. You know, that's fine. Other payers have been real sticklers for saying that you need to start a new antidepressant. And from a medical standpoint, this feels wrong, right? Like we're starting a new esketamine. We don't want to introduce someone new to the mix. But so usually a couple weeks before we would theoretically start a new antidepressant and, you know, usually set expectations with these patients. I found these are usually folks where, you know, I think most payers require like 2 failed trials. These people have like 8 failed trials, right? This is tends to be quite a treatment resistant population. So a lot of these folks are like, I don't want to try another oral antidepressant. Why are you making me do this? But it is part of the protocol. Unfortunately, it's part of the thing that payers will fixate on. So I will send the prescription in. We don't have any way of knowing if the patient actually, you know, puts the pill in their mouth, but we do have to encourage that type of usage. It doesn't make sense. And then, you know, some of these, they won't approve for bipolar disorder. It really has to be for treatment-resistant depression. They will flag things like recent substance use disorders in the chart, things like that, a psychotic illness, those sorts of things, which, you know, should raise, I would say that those would raise flags anyway, substance use and psychosis. Whether or not this is safe and tolerant in bipolar is sort of another ongoing question. And it is used off-label. Sometimes these will go doc to doc. And so I think that even when you're working with a service like Tidemark, or you have somebody in-house administratively, oftentimes this is going to come down to you doing a doc to doc with some other doctor that may or may not be a psychiatrist. And usually in these ones, I, you know, always check expedited review, stat review, urgent. And usually these are cases where I'm like, look, this person is going to go to the hospital. Like they're going to go to the ER. Like this is an emergency. Like this is approved for suicidal ideation. Like we need to not mess around here. So I think it's really okay to be quite forceful regarding the acuity, what the stakes are. And usually we've been able to get them through for patients who really need it. So just to fight for the patient here on this. Don't give up.
Yeah. There's a question in the chat that says, do they approve for PTSD? Most often, it's only approved for major depressive disorder. They still consider any treatment for bipolar and or PTSD to be off-label use, but they are reviewing that on a quarterly basis to see if they will approve it. But so far, all of the clinical research says there's not enough evidence for that, at least on for their primary diagnosis. It's blurring a little bit of a gray, area as far as what you want to put as in regards to a primary diagnosis. However, if major depressive disorder would fit, in your box one slot for your primary diagnosis, then you can put that and only bill out for just the primary diagnosis on that claim form. It's not required that you bill out or even divulge to the carrier any subsequent diagnoses that you have. And I have this conversation with providers a lot that more often than not, they won't even include any Z codes that you're including or any V codes, relationship problems. And there's just a lot of substance abuse like history and background that they won't cover as well across payers. And that is, I guess, probably a good point to bring up that typically when conducting a prior authorization, they tend to frown upon any recent, and by recent, I mean within the last year, substance abuse history for these patients, just because there is, there would be an abuse potential if they were able to get a hold of more than just the dosage that you're administering in your clinic. But they don't want to trigger anything else. And it's also important to realize that if you are going to be a group clinic and you aren't just a solo provider, that all of your other providers, unless you are conducting incident two billing or supervisory billing, that they also have to be credentialed as well as yourself and your group clinic. And you can't just bill out if you happen to be credentialed underneath your type one MPI, which is just your individual, also sometimes referred to as your rendering MPI. You cannot bill out for that if it's a different provider in box 33B, which is your billing MPI. That would be considered insurance fraud if you did that. As far as the prior authorizations go, that's really what is going to be your best bet as far as getting something approved. So these are the buy and bill codes that specifically you see for Spravato. Now, what I was saying with the G codes, G2082 and 2083, that's for either the 56 milligram dosage or the 84 milligram dosage. You don't use any other code visits, any other office visits in conjunction with these G codes, because it's considered to all be inclusive for the entire treatment. If you're with commercial payers, historically, that would be your S code that you would utilize for that. And you will need to include, when you're billing out for that S code, you will need to include the NDC codes. And I've listed them below just so that you have them as well. And you are going to use office visits accordingly. And if you are unaware of what those office visits are, anything that is a new patient intake, that's going to be your 99202s through fives. It's going to be any sort of 90833s through 38s if you're doing any add-on therapy codes, 90785 for interactive complexity. Most of the time, insurance payers, even if you include it on the claim form, will not pay for a 96127, which is your depression inventories, your PHQ-9s, because they consider that to be part of a typical service the psychiatric providers and mental health providers provide. So they typically won't reimburse for those unless you're just a general PCP and or even a CRNA, because we do have some anesthesiologists here as well. As far as add-on codes for prolonged visits, I do need to make it clear that the add-on codes for 99354 and 99355 were sunsetted as of 2022. So you can't use those for any additional like prolonged services. You will see some websites out there that say that you can use 99358-9 in place of it, but that is not true. That is only for inpatient monitoring, not for outpatient clinic visits, observation and monitoring. Right now, the only code that they have currently is for prolonged visits is a 99417, and you can only use your highest tiered coding with that, which is your 99205 for your initial visit, or your 99215 for follow-up visits. And you can bill up to 4 units of that 417. This would be a good point for you guys to realize that if you haven't been credentialed yet and or you're out of network or have the room to negotiate your rate for what they're going to reimburse for whatever code groupings that you're going to use, that this would be where that would fit in. And you have a strong case to make that you were able to be reimbursed at a higher rate of reimbursement, you know, during the year of 2022. Just because of those add-on codes versus what you're being able to get reimbursed at currently. Any questions about, can you add psychotherapy to the G code? No, you cannot. Those are mutually exclusive. There's something called NCCI edits, and it tells you what codes you can bill on the same day by the same provider and or by a different provider. And if you are familiar with the Availity portal, there is in payer spaces, there is a McKesson claim check tool that you can basically punch in CPT codes, diagnoses codes with or without modifiers, and it'll tell you whether it's allowed as a particular code grouping or not. And that's the easiest way to know if you can bill something together or not versus downloading the spreadsheet and then learning how to interpret it.
Enjoying the Psychiatry Tomorrow podcast and hungry for even more insights into the future of mental health care? Then you won't want to miss out on the Psychiatry Tomorrow newsletter from OzMind. Join hundreds of forward-thinking psychiatrists and mental health professionals staying ahead of the curve with the latest research, technology, and practice strategies delivered straight to your inbox. It's free, it's easy, and it's the best way to keep your finger on the pulse of mental health care. Just head to ozmind.org/tomorrow and we'll see you inside. Brittany, we have another couple more detailed questions I think would be best to save to the end. But I think before we move on to the next slide, I think it would be helpful. Could you just say, my understanding is that the most common use right now is basically 99215 plus like the, what is it, multiple, it would be like 299417. No, sorry, 494, right? So 99215 with 4 units of 99417 for basically a 2-hour extended E&M visit that you're saying it's a time-based complex situation that you're doing, mm-hmm. right? Is that what you see most commonly? And then if the medication is buy and bill, you add the S code. Is that fair to say for non-Medicare?
Yes, that is correct. And for an initial consult or an initial appointment, it would be your 99205 and your 99417s with the additional 4 units. It would also be relevant to say that you can bill for a 90785, which is your interactive complexity mm-hmm. codes, which is anything that makes treatment harder. And it's not going to fetch you a whole lot of money. It's only going to be like a difference between, you know, $6 to $13 or so, give or take, depending on your region and the payer. But it adds up over time, and most of your clients would qualify qualify, or patients would qualify for that interactive complexity add-on.
And then the Medicare code is very interesting. So this G2212 code, it used to not exist when Spravato first came out. Mm-hmm. And actually, for folks that are American Psychiatric Association members, some of your membership dues mm-hmm. went to lobbying for this, actually. The APA worked very hard to get this code included. And this code is really interesting because it includes the cost of the drug plus pretty generous reimbursement of the session. So it, you know, varies in your area, but like in the New York City area, I would say after the cost of the drug, this was netting, you know, just like $400-$500 a session. And, you know, that can add up if you're doing multiple sessions. So it definitely became a much more viable path once that code was added to Medicare, I would say. And I think Medicaid may use it too as well now, but I'm not sure.
Medicaid does use the code as well. Again, it's just going to vary on the different Medicaid payers statewide because some of them have updated their policies, some of them haven't. But if you're ever in doubt, it's either going to be in your most recent edition of your provider manual and or the billing guidelines that you would find on their website. And you can always search for it. I wouldn't recommend calling any representatives and asking them because they'll just tell you, we can't give you any advice as far as billing. Good luck. So that's just a road that you don't want to bark down. Other thing that's probably a good thing to add here too, is that, I've gotten a lot of questions from providers, about whether PMHNPs can perform like, these services, right? Without an MD being on site. There are a few handful of payers. Again, you need to check with your state licensing board first, because regardless of whatever an insurance payer says is acceptable, doesn't mean that your licensing board says it is acceptable. But if it checks out with your licensing board and it checks out with the payer, then yes, there are a handful of cases where your mid-level practitioners can perform the services as opposed to a psychiatrist. But that will grossly affect your reimbursement rates because you're getting paid only in a 75 or 85% rate level, depending on the provider type, as opposed to your MD rates of pay.
All right. Maybe we should, let's move on. And then I think probably come back to the end to some of this coding stuff because it is devil's in the detail.
As far as insurance coverage goes, then you really want to make sure that you're doing your provider directory updates and your revalidation paperwork to stay in network. I can't tell you how many times, specifically in their CAQH profiles, providers are notorious for not updating their most recent practice addresses in the clinics that they're working at. And so, and they're not updating their credentialing point of contact addresses, which is the main culprit. And so what we're finding is a lot of times re-credentialing paperwork with payers, it tends to happen every 5 to 7 years, depending on the payer. It's getting sent to like an address that may not even be in existence anymore. And then those providers fall off out of network. And that you don't get any notice. They don't send you any email notices. And suddenly claims start denying just because you're an out-of-network provider. And suddenly things that didn't require prior auths now do require prior auths. And then everybody has a small minor meltdown. And then we all get it corrected. But please... Yes. Please understand that unless you have good connections with your provider rep, that getting that revalidation pushed back through some reps with some payers will tell you, I'm sorry, you have to submit a brand new application over again. We can't do anything to help you. And it could take you another 180 days to get back in network. And you would be faced with that. So I don't want to minimize the gravity that this could cause for your providers and for your clinic and just even for your cash flow in general. Most definitely, when you are renewing your malpractice policies, your DEA licenses, your professional licenses, not only do you want to update that in your CAQH profile that you have, but you need to be updating it across all payers as well. And every payer has a different method of how they want to be updated. Some want you to email them. Some want you to complete a form on their website. Some want you to fax it to them. And then other ones, it just suffices to just keep keep it in CAQH. So what I do with my clinic is I know what all of the insurance payers are that I'm on, and I keep a running contact list for those payers so that it's real easy to update when it comes time for all of my practitioners in my clinic to do any sort of malpractice or licensing updates. And specifically, if you're taking Medicaid, please do understand that if you are not updating that with the state, at the state Medicaid level, that actually will cause you to become out of network with all of the various MCOs that are there. And MCOs are just managed carve-outs. So you might hear things like Amerigroup, Superior, United Healthcare Community Plans. Those are some common names for just some of the Medicaids. And it's not until that state Medicaid plan updates that you're going to really be able to start that they'll list you as an in-network provider again. Those are typically easy fixes. Usually the turnaround time for that is a couple of weeks. And then you just do a claims project to get them all corrected. You should know that the state master files for all of the state Medicaid plans don't update except once a week, and they only send it to all of the managed care organizations every single Friday. So you want to make sure you hit that deadline if you do have to update it before that Friday. And I know that that's being oddly specific and it may not be relevant to you, but do try to file that away somewhere in your memory banks, because it does create quite an issue for your whole entire clinic and even potentially the course of treatment for your patients. Because the last thing you want to do is be billing out for Spravato, having the cost of the drug potentially, and then not being able to get paid for a single dime of it until you get it corrected 6 months down the road. That's a huge costly mistake if you're going to try to continue treating your patients in the meantime.
I also have a pro tip around these types of like lessons learned is patients coming to you in December to start Spravato, please ask them if they will be changing their insurance come January 1st, or if someone is about to change their job. Please, please, please make sure that they understand that if they are to change their insurance in the middle of this treatment, it will be disrupted. And so we do not want that. And so sometimes it means people have cobra'd to continue a course of treatment or whatever, but just patients don't think about that. And those are two key moments where I've definitely run into some unfortunate snags with delays.
Yes. And to also point out too, it's very important that your front desk or whomever is answering the phones, that you are differentiating between your traditional Medicare cards for traditional Medicare versus your Medicare carve-outs and your supplementals, and that your front desk know the difference between being able to identify those, because most of the time patients will still just present with their red, white, and blue card. And it turns out that they've opted into a Medicare Advantage plan, and you'll have jumped through all these hoops potentially to secure a prior authorization with traditional Medicare and completed all this paperwork and have it be for naught because you submitted it to the wrong plan type. And then you're just going to have to redo it again. And I would encourage you, for whatever PDFs that you might have to fill out, save a template of it so you don't have to keep refilling it out every single time on the fields that are, you know, are applicable. Work smarter, not harder. And that typically tends to streamline the process a little bit. When it comes to directory updates, those are the things that happen every 30, 60, 90 days, depending on the payer. And it's usually just a click of a button in the provider portal that says, no, my data hasn't changed. And that's basically just them wanting to make sure that you're still at the correct address. It doesn't have anything to do with your licensing, your malpractice insurance, or anything of that nature. When it comes to other than having a good, strong front desk staff who schedule well, you definitely want to make sure that you're conducting a correct verification of benefits as much as possible. So you're going to have to be asking some very specific questions to the provider reps. The very first question that we always ask is, did you transfer me to the correct department? Because we are behavioral health. We're not medical. If you are performing behavioral health services, if you're a medical provider, obviously you would still get transferred to the medical side of things. That is the very first question that you want to ask. The next question that you want to ask, specifically if you're on Blue Cross Blue Shield plans, or Anthem plans, Empire, Regents, Premera, those are all the different names for Blue Cross. You want to make sure that you're getting forwarded to the correct plan specific to your state, but you're also going to want to make sure that they are quoting you the benefits, specifically if it's an HMO plan, which is typically your plans that are purchased through the Marketplace Exchange Program. And they're covered by third-party carve-outs that are Magellan, or Beacon Health is another one. Kaiser took over for Beacon Health. Carelon also took over for Beacon Health and some of the other regions of the United States. And you're going to want to specifically ask if they're giving you a quota benefits for just the medical side of the Blue Cross plans, or whether it's actually for the carve out, because your network status is going to change and they may be quoting you as in network when you're really not, if they're not looking at the correct screen. You're going to want to be very thorough. And when you're asking for your providers, for whoever's going to be performing the service, you're going to want to make sure that they are actually in network, but you're going to want to specify, are they really at network at this address with this tax ID, with this NPI number? Because it could be that they have an outdated profile and maybe they switched from a type one and billing out of their own tax ID at your clinic address to billing out as your group clinic tax ID and your group clinic NPI number. Or it could be that they're in network at another clinic or even in another state and they're just quoting them as in network when nobody's really done the credentialing for them to be in network at your clinic. Yeah, so, and that tends to happen a lot. So you do have to be that specific as far as the address, NPI, and tax ID.
So yeah, so just really quickly, I think, you know, running this business, obviously there's a lot of complexities and working with a firm like Tidemark regarding all of the insurance piece, I think can be really key to making this profitable. And in addition, I think running, you know, multiple cases at the same time, similar to ketamine, kind of having a setup where you're able to support that. Because once you start doing two cases at once, slightly staggered, but you're obviously observing both, it starts to become quite a viable business model. If you're just doing the one, it really is going to depend on your insurance contract, if that's going to be worth your time. So it is kind of a economies of scale type of things. But one of the things I found most rewarding about it is that there were patients that either were never able to afford ketamine or they've sort of exhausted their funds with ketamine and now they're able to use their insurance. So it does open up this treatment to a much wider modality. Say what you will about the cost of the drug that the payer's paying and what Janssen, you know, all of that people have criticized. But I think ultimately from an accessibility standpoint, this has been a game changer. Getting Medicare, Medicaid patients these treatments is, you know, extremely, extremely rewarding. Especially, I think if you're also set up to do things like TMS or IV ketamine, adding Spravato, like you'll find you have a lot of the same workflows in place, a lot of the same administrative infrastructure. And that's why for our practice, we had TMS, we had a well-oiled TMS machine. We were able to really switch over to Spravato really quickly, right when it launched. So just in terms of kind of setting and systems, you will have to register with the REMS program, and that will really lay out how you conduct your visit. You know, when you do your vital sign checks, it does not need to be continuous monitoring, but it is at certain points. It does have to be that full 2 hours. I think Janssen typically recommends no more than 2 at once, kind of simultaneously. I have heard of more, it just gets logistically complicated. And one thing to really keep in mind is you do need to have a REMS certified clinician on site. That could be a nurse practitioner, could be a psychiatrist, MD, you know, whoever it is that's gone through the certification. They have to physically be on the premises. However, you know, you can have the prescribing clinician do the check-in. So sometimes I might not be on site, but some other doctor would be on site kind of manning the ship in case of an emergency. But I would do a Zoom visit to do that initial check-in because I have that alliance with the patient. And then you have just, you know, technicians, staff kind of doing the vital sign checking the same way you would, you know, have assistance for ketamine. So it's not that you're doing everything, but it does usually require a little bit of a production in terms of staff and use of things like iPads with video or baby monitors, getting your room kind of set up. And we can certainly talk more about that if you're going down that path. You'll also need a safe, secure safe, you know, put protocols in place around that. The DEA is pretty particular. And if you are offering Spravato, the chances of the DEA coming for a little visit, you know, are pretty high. So you want to make sure everything is in order there. They also have a disposal program with the pharmacy benefit. One of the nice things about it is you don't have to worry about paying for the drug. One of the downsides is actually the program says the medication expires or can't be used after 2 weeks when it's a prescription. It's kind of silly. Whereas when you get it from a distributor, you can store it and you can use it for different patients because it's not tied to a specific patient the way a prescription is. So I actually prefer the buy and bill, and you can negotiate rates and such and pay, you know, do a like 90-day pay cycle and all different things like that. Yeah. So just an example of different setups, private room versus, you know, shared room with a screen. You guys kind of figure out what you want. I typically would use more of like a couch setup. A lot of people like to lay down, blanket, you know, really, again, similar to what you might use for ketamine. So just wanted to touch on a little bit. I know there's lots of EHRs out there. Osmind really, it is the only one I've seen that does have really baked in customability to Spravato. So in particular, when you do your note for Spravato, it's fully templated out. And instead of needing to submit a separate form via a separate portal or faxing a separate thing and double documenting, once you're done with your note in Osmind, it's, you know, one click and it gets sent to that REMS program directly. So I wish that I had that when I was, you know, back in the day, starting out in 2019, that would have saved a ton of time. We're the only ones that have that. In addition, we also have a very structured intake you can send to patients that's going to collect all that minutia about prior med trials that you're going to need for your prior auths and prior therapy. And so it stores it in a really structured fashion that's really easy to use. We're able to prescribe. And, you know, again, Dr. First has built in prior authorization capabilities. And then last but certainly not least, as Brittany was mentioning, measurement-based care is really big in Spravato. And so doing different rating scales that are both clinician rated as well as sent to patients is key. And our system makes that really easy to do. We, you know, things like PHQ-9, HAM-D, GAD-7, the dissociative scale, Sheehan disability scale, the MADRS is the one that was typically used in the studies. And then the mood monitor, that's really just send the little mood rating daily or however much you want to do. We make that all really easy. So it's just sort of like a one-stop shop for Spravato, which is pretty awesome. All right. So I think we're going to start to take some questions. I know Brittany does offer services for billing and obviously is an expert in this area. So if you want to get in touch with her, that's how you'll do it. So I did write down a few questions. One, I'm not necessarily going to go in the order they appeared because I think some of them are just probably more salient to answer really quickly. So what is the average cost of the drug? All right. So typically, keep in mind, it comes in the 28 milligram, I don't know what you call that, canister. And typically, most patients are going to be on 84 milligrams. So one thing is usually for a new patient who's starting for depression, the first day you do 54, and vast majority of patients' subsequent visits are 84 milligrams, unless they really did not tolerate it. If you're doing it for suicidality, acute suicidality, you can actually start with 84 straight away if the patient is comfortable. I'm just going to say like the price for like the three canisters for 84 milligrams is, I'm seeing usually between 800 something and 900 something from the buy and bill. It does vary. It varies if you're based, you know, buying in bulk. We use Best, the supplier. There's a couple out there. You can usually do arrangements, but that's usually around the cost. I don't know, Brittany, if you've seen anything different?
Bessie Medical tends to be the cheaper one that we've seen around the nation. We've had some clinics get pretty good contracted rates for pretty low, but we're typically seeing anywhere between the $700 to $850 range at least for just the cost of the
Room. And this is, you know, I think one of the things that I liked was that they do have like, you buy it, but you can pay within 90 days and with some of these. So basically the idea would be then by that point, you've submitted the claim, it's been adjudicated, the payers paid, they paid you for the cost of the drug. So you're pretty good in that regard. So do any of these codes apply to IV or IM ketamine sessions or only Spravato? You know, so these are really only for Spravato. People do interesting billing off label for ketamine, but that's beyond the scope. I don't, you know, typically what we're talking about today is just for S-ketamine. And these are the ones that are, you know, if you were audited, they would stand up and say, basically, these are medically necessary codes for the procedures that you're doing since it's FDA approved. Would Medicaid only pay 80% if a PA handles the treatment? Brittany, do you know the answer to that?
The answer to that is yes. Like, so if they are just considered to be a master's level provider, they're only going to be getting reimbursed at the 85% rate, unless you're doing incident to billing.
Right, where then it's billed under the supervisor, right? So if you have like a more of a trainee type situation, or if your contract allows that type of provider to incident to bill, and which does get to an interesting thing around contracting. So what's the typical rate of reimbursement you've seen with your contracts? We've gotten several questions along those lines. I have seen it honestly vary quite widely, to the point where in my practice, there were some payers we just refused to work with anymore because it just was not financially viable. Whereas other contracts, we were able to negotiate rates. It gets down to things like the 99417s. Like, are they going to treat those nicely and pay four of them and pay you well? Are you going to be able to, you know, work with the payer when you're doing your contracting to make sure you're getting, you know, as much juice as you can out of that lemon? It really does vary payer to payer. And honestly, I've been surprised that sometimes the Medicare and Medicaid, commercial Medicaid, has been actually some of the best in this regard. I think our practice, just straightforwardly, we worked a lot with Cigna. We had a very good relationship with folks at Cigna and were able to negotiate very viable contracts. Whereas when we tried to do like one-off single case agreements with folks like Aetna, we weren't overall in network. As Brittany said, that's kind of an uphill battle and is kind of plus minus. And then I think Optum United, for us at least, was not always that great, but there's so much geographic variability. Brittany, what do you see folks getting, you know, good success with?
So we tend to see that most often with the Medicaid payers, they tend to get more success with that, and they tend to be a little bit more streamlined. And actually, a lot of the MCOs are really on board with Spravato, and they're like excited about it compared to some of the commercial payers even. We tend to find Health First is something to steer
New
clear
York
of.
Medicaid.
In New York. Yes. You know, we've had a few other problems with United Healthcare Community and the Medicare lines of business with United Healthcare recently, and it's just because they're not wanting to pay out for add-on codes that you're utilizing, and or they're grossly under reimbursing or misapplying payments and putting it towards patient responsibility when they shouldn't be.
Yeah, funny business, which Brittany's always very good at catching.
Yeah.
We do have to wrap up. One very quick, easy one I get answer, and then we'll end. These have been great questions. Do we need to update our DEA for Schedule 2? So no, S-ketamine and ketamine are actually Schedule 3. So keep that in mind. Most of the time, if you're prescribing controlled substances, you have that Schedule 3 checked off. And I know in some states, NPs can't do Schedule 2, but you should be good to go for the S-ketamine. So thank you for joining. That is Brittany's contact. And of course, if you're not already using Osmind, please feel free to book a demo to learn more. We are able to bill insurance through Osmind for S-ketamine and building more robust services around that as well. But really can be a one-stop shop. And the Spravato website has distributors. It also has a registry. So when you get registered to provide Spravato, you can opt in to be on that directory. And I will say that can be a nice source of referrals. Folks do go to that website to find you.
We've also had good luck with clinics using RefferralMD specifically for Spravato if they're wanting to look for a software product. And then we have another clinic that is working on streamlining, just getting those referrals set up for patients too, and trying to get it out there to the mass public. And so there is more details on that later to come.
All right. So thank you, and everybody. Is there any other closing words, any housekeeping that I missed?
I appreciate you all being here. Feel free to visit osmind.org and follow us on social media to kind of get some recaps from today's amazing webinar. Thank you both so much, Dr. Carlene and Brittany. Appreciate you both so much for coming on today. And I hope everyone has a wonderful day.
Likewise.
That's it for today's episode of the Psychiatry Tomorrow podcast. We hope you found our discussion informative and inspiring. If you enjoyed the show, why not share it with one mental health clinician in your network? Your support means the world to us and helps us reach a wider audience. And if you're enjoying the podcast, we'd really appreciate it if you could leave us a rating and review on your favorite podcast platform. It only takes a moment, and your feedback helps us to improve the show and reach even more listeners who are passionate about mental health. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the future.